was a large cardboard box. "It's our souvenirs from Mexico," said Remy. Wendy Corden was working at one of the computers in the area across the room.
"That came a few minutes ago. I signed for it."
"Thanks," said Sam. He lifted the box up onto a work table, giving it a gentle shake. "I didn't hear anything broken."
"Don't even say that," said Salma. "I can't believe you shipped it that way. Just mailed it home like a piece of crockery."
"You had to be there to appreciate our choices. People kept trying to steal it." Selma produced a box cutter from a desk drawer and handed it to Sam.
"Can we see it?"
Sam opened the box. He removed some of the packing peanuts, then some of the wall hangings and mats. Selma unrolled one of them, then two others.
"These are truly dreadful," she said. "That king looks a bit like Elvis. Who has come to think of it, the king?"
She unwrapped a small pot.
"And look at these. Sparkly paint in case this warrior gentleman isn't fancy enough."
Remy laughed. "I think those were the inspiration for Sam's improvements to the real pot." Sam reached in and gently lifted the genuine Mayan pot. He set it upright on the table. Selma moaned.
"That is horrifying. Gold and silver paint. That's vandalism."
"It comes off," he said. "I read one time that a lot of great Egyptian art got to Europe disguised as cheap replicas. The trick still works." Sam used his cell phone to dial Dr. David Kane's office at the university.
"Dr. Kane," he said, "the delivery I was waiting for has arrived. Would you like to take a look?"
"I'd love the chance," Kane said. "When can I come?"
"Any time from now on. We'll be here until evening."
Sam recited the address.
"I'll be there in an hour."
Sam terminated the call and then turned to the others. "He'll be here in an hour. I'd better wipe this sparkly paint off right away, or he'll be as horrified as Selma." An hour later, their guest arrived. Dr. David Kane was in his mid-40s, very fit and tanned, wearing jeans and a summer-weight sport coat over a black polo shirt. As he stepped through the doorway into the vast office space, he saw the pot on the table across the room and could barely draw his eyes away from it. He stopped and shook Sam's hand.
"You must be Sam. I'm Dave Kane."
Remy stepped up.
"I'm Remy. Come this way.
I can tell you're dying to see the pot." He followed her across the open hardwood floor, but when he was still 6 feet from the pot, he stopped and stared at it for a moment, then walked around it, looking at it from every angle.
"I read the article and looked at the pictures you sent me, but seeing one of these in person is always a moment," he said. "I always feel a bit of excitement. The pottery, the paintings, always contain a little bit of the personality of the artist. When I see a water pitcher shaped like a fat little dog, it's like going back in time to meet the potter."
"I know what you mean," Remy said.
"I love that too, when the actual human being is staring back at you from 1,000 years ago.
Kane came in toward the table and looked closely at the pot.
"But this one is different.
It's obviously a prime piece, classic period. A day in the life of the King of Copan." He straightened and looked at the Fargos.
"You know that discoveries like this have to be reported to the government of Mexico, right?"
"Of course," said Sam. "We were in the middle of a natural disaster, and there wasn't any reasonable safe way to do that, or any authorities who had time to deal with it. We'll return the pot when we've had a chance to learn what we can about it."
"It's a relief that you know the rules," he said.
Remy said,
"Are you sure it's from Copan? We found this at Tacaná, north of Tapachula, Mexico. That's at least 400 miles from Copan."
Kane shrugged. "Native people in the Americas sometimes covered a lot of ground on foot. There's also trade."
"How old is it?"
Kane cocked his head and looked.
"Wait, here we go. The king is Yaspasha Chanyopat, the 16th ruler of Copan. It says so here."
He pointed at a group of vertical columns with rounded designs like seals. Sam said, "You can read those?"
"Yes.
These columns each consist of 1 to 5 glyphs, and each glyph is a word or phrase or an indication of a position in a sentence. You read from top left to right, but only for the first 2 columns, then go down a line and read the left one and the right one and so on. There are 861 glyphs that we know.
There are over 20 Mayan languages, said Remy.
Does this form of writing work for all of them?
No, he said. The only ones we have were written in Cholhan, Tzeltalhan, and Yucatec.
Sam stared at the pot.
So this comes from Copan. I wonder how it got from Honduras all the way across Guatemala to the border of Mexico.
And when? Said Remy. Exactly what I was wondering, said Kane.
We could do a carbon date on any organic material associated with the find, and on the man himself. That would do it.
I'll call Dr. Talamantes and Dr. Garza and see if they can arrange to have the man tested, said Remy. He's in a hospital morgue in Tapachula. They signed him in, mostly on the strength of the goodwill they built up with the medical community in the area after the earthquake.
Are they also archaeologists? Asked Kane.
No, just medical doctors, said Sam.
Then would you mind if I stepped in and got a couple of Mexican colleagues to go to work on this? They're first-rate scientists, and very well respected.
We'd be delighted, said Remy.
Then I'll call them this afternoon and get them going on it.
You've done a good job of keeping his location quiet since the first blast of publicity, so there hasn't been a crush of people trying to get in and see him. But you can be sure that lots of people are waiting and listening, some scholars and scientists, and some crackpots and some charlatans as always.
Sam said, "The publicity came from another volunteer who was up there with us. He didn't believe in keeping the find quiet based on his own principles. The discovery belongs to the people, so the people should be told about it. We thought we'd talked him into waiting, but he went public without us. After that, we took steps to give the scientific community a chance to see things before the tourists and souvenir hunters destroyed them.
It's a good thing you did.
Do we have anything here we can carbon date?
Remy said, quite a bit. Our guy made himself a pair of dishes out of hollowed-out pieces of wood. There was some plant residue in one of them.
Perfect, said Kane. Anything living begins to lose carbon 14 the minute it dies.
I'll get them.
She went off to the other end of the room, disappeared through a door, and came back with the 2 plastic bags containing the wooden vessels, seeds, and husks. Kane returned his attention to the pot.
This pot has a lid. The seal looks translucent, a bit like beeswax. Have you opened it?
No, said Sam. We realized that the minute we cleared the lava out of the doorway to the shrine, or whatever that building is, we exposed the man and his belongings to air and started the clock ticking. We didn't want to do anything that might harm the pot. We've carried it around quite a bit, so we know the contents aren't liquid and aren't stone or metal, but it's not empty. Something shifts around a little when you move it.
Shall we try to open it now? Asked Kane.
We have a good place to do it, Remy said. In our remodeling, we've had the builders put in a climate-controlled room. Low temperature, low humidity, no sunlight. Just like a rare book room in a library.
Wonderful, said Kane.
Follow me. She led them to the door she had just emerged from, opened it, and turned on the light. The room had a long work table and a few chairs and a wall of glass cabinets, all of them empty at the moment. In the corner of the room was a tall red tool chest on wheels that looked like the ones in auto mechanics shops. Professor Kane carried the pot into the room and set it on the table. Sam wheeled the chest over and opened the top drawer, which held a collection of tools for working on small, delicate objects. Brushes, tweezers, X-Acto knives, dental picks, awls, magnifiers, and high-intensity flashlights. There was also a box of sterile surgical gloves. Kane put on gloves, chose a pick and tweezers to examine the seal and pull some of it off. He looked at it under a magnifier on a stand.
It seems to be a glue made from some kind of plant resin.
He switched to an X-Acto knife and methodically cut away the translucent substance from around the lid.
"What's in there can't be food. It's glued shut," said Remy.
"I don't dare guess," said Kane. "Archaeology is full of high hopes and pots that turn out to be full of mud."
He gripped the lid and twisted.
"Interesting. I can turn the lid a little, but not raise it. What it looks like is that he heated the pot a little, sealed it, and let it cool. That would produce a partial vacuum in it to keep the seal tight."
"Just like canning," said Remy.
"Maybe it is food. Now I wonder how to get it open without breaking it."
Sam said, "We could heat it a bit again to get the air inside to expand, or we could take it up to a high altitude where the air pressure is lower."
"How could we warm it a bit without harming it?"
"If we do it evenly, the pot shouldn't break," said Sam.
"I agree," Kane said. "Another modification to the house. We put in a sauna," said Remy.
They climbed the stairs to the second floor, and Sam entered the sauna, placed the pot on a wooden bench, then turned on the heat, slowly raising the temperature. At the end of 10 minutes, he entered the sauna, wrapped the pot in a towel, and brought it out. He held the pot while Kane tried the lid. It came up, and the pressure was equalized. Sam put the lid back on, and they all went back downstairs to the climate-controlled room.
"The big moment is coming," said Remy. "Don't be disappointed if it's just a mess of organic matter that used to be food," said Kane. "Sometimes the best bits of information don't look like much at first."
Sam set the pot on the table. Kane, still wearing surgical gloves, took a deep breath and reached in. He pulled out a mass of what looked like dried weeds.
"Packing material?"
He picked up a small flashlight and looked inside the pot.
"Oh."
He stood up and peered down into the vessel.
"Is it possible?"
"What is it?"
"It looks like a book," he said. "A Mayan book."
"Can you get it out?" Kane put both hands into the vessel and lifted out a thick brownish rectangle and gently set it on the table. He reached out slowly with only his gloved index finger, lifted the outer layer an inch. His voice was a hoarse whisper.
"Intact. I can't believe it."
For a moment he stood still, lost in thought. He withdrew his finger and only then seemed to notice the Fargos again. His whole face brightened.
"It's a Mayan book. A codex. It seems to be undamaged. We have to take our time examining it because we don't know how fragile it is, and there's no way to know how many times a page can be turned or even touched."
"I know they're very rare," Remy said.
"The rarest of all Western Hemisphere artifacts, and by far the most valuable," said Kane. "The Maya were the only people in the Americas who developed a complex system of writing, and it's good. They could write anything they could say. If they'd had the urge, they could have written novels, epic poems, histories."
"Maybe they did.
There were once hundreds of thousands of these codices. Today there are only 4 that survived and made it into European museums. The Dresden Codex, the Madrid Codex, the Paris. And there's also the Grolier Codex, but it's so inferior to the others that many experts think it's a forgery. But the first 3 are full of Mayan knowledge. Mathematics, astronomy, cosmology, calendars. This could be the 5th.
"You said there were once thousands," said Remy.
"Hundreds of thousands is a better estimate," he said. "But there were 2 problems. The codices were painted on a fabric made from the bark of a wild fig tree called Ficus glabrata. The fabric was folded into pages, and the pages painted with a white mixture like stucco. That gave the Maya white pages they could write on. They were better than papyrus, almost as good as paper."
"What were the problems?"
"One was the climate. Most of the Mayan country was humid jungle. When books get wet, they rot. Some codices were buried in tombs, some at Copan, some at Altunja in Belize, some at Huaxactungaytan.
The fig bark fabric rotted, leaving little piles of painted stucco fragments too small and delicate to ever be pieced together. But the biggest problem arrived in ships. "The Spanish conquest," said Sam. "Mainly the priests. They made a point of destroying anything having to do with native religions. Mayan gods looked like devils to them. They burned every book they found, and then searched every hiding place so no book could survive. This went on from the beginning of the Mayan conquest in the 1500s until the 1690s, when they took the last cities. That's why only 4 are left." "And now 5, said Remy. "It's a spectacular find," said Kane. "Do you have a place to put it where it will be safe?"
"We do," said Sam. "We'll lock it up tight."
"Good. I'd like to get started on the dating process and then come back tomorrow to start examining the codex. Is that possible?"
"I'd say it's mandatory," said Sam. "We're as curious as you are, and we can't satisfy our curiosity without you."
Chapter 7. La Jolla. The next afternoon, Sam and Remy were waiting when David Kane arrived. After Sam and Remy took him into the climate-controlled room, Remy put on surgical gloves, opened one of the glass cabinets, and set the codex on the table. Kane sat for a moment, staring at the cover.
"Before we begin," he said, "the carbon dating is complete on the seeds and husks that were in the wooden bowls and on the wood itself. The samples all had 94.29% of their carbon-14. The wood and the plants died at about the same time, which is 476 years ago, in 1537.
"Isn't that sort of late for a classic Mayan?" asked Remy.
"It's well into the end time of the civilization.
Most major classic cities had been abandoned by around 1000 A.D.
Others stood until the Spanish got to them, beginning around 1524, when Pedro de Alvarado attacked the Maya with a huge army of native allies from Tlaxcala and Cholula. But there were many Mayan kingdoms that took a long time to be conquered. The last few fell in 1697, more than 150 years later. Remy said, "So what we found was a high-ranking man who picked up a pot from somewhere near Copan in Honduras. He put a book inside it and set off on foot. He went 400 miles or so, then climbed all the way up the side of the Tacaná volcano in Mexico and put it in a shrine."
"I would say it's almost certain that something of that sort happened.
Why he did it, we can only guess at this point."
"Do you have a guess?" asked Sam.
"I think that he was taking an extremely precious book to a secret and remote place to hide it from the Spaniards. Judging from your photographs of the site, you're probably right that it was a small stone shrine. Inside are pictures of Sisin, god of earthquakes and death, who was the bringer of earthquakes. He's the dancing skeleton with the dangling eyeballs."
"Then what?"
"I'm just guessing, remember? At some point, the shrine was covered by a lava flow from the volcano. It's even possible that he intentionally placed the book in the shrine, knowing the likelihood that it would be covered by lava, believing that a god was giving him a perfect way to seal the book in a safe place."
"Do you think he would do that?" Kane shrugged.
"The Mayans had a strong belief in an afterlife in which they would be rewarded or punished. They also believed that the universe was kept in balance by what they did. Much of the knowledge they accumulated in books about astronomy and mathematics was intended to tell them what they should do to keep the universe from spinning out of control and destroying itself like an unbalanced machine. By 1537, this man's universe had been showing signs of coming apart for hundreds of years. There had been terrible droughts from 750 to 900 A.D., a series of wars between cities, disease, and then the Spaniards came.
Their arrival in 1524 was like the landing of aliens in a horror movie. They carried weapons nobody could fight or make for themselves.
They were bent on destroying what remained of Mayan civilization and killing or enslaving every Mayan person. It was the final curse after a long series of curses. A Mayan, and this was a person of the royal class, would have taken the long view. These are people whose calendar was divided into cycles 5,125 years long. He might have believed that the book he was saving contained information essential to keeping the world intact or rebuilding it in the future. I suppose then he wouldn't hesitate to sacrifice himself to save the book. Cain said, "Imagine that powerful human-like creatures arrived here in spaceships, killed or enslaved everyone they could find, and then began the process of finding every computer, every book, and burning it. Oops, there goes the history of art, and after it, every painting. There goes calculus, algebra, even arithmetic. They're burning the books of every religion, all Bibles, the Quran, the Talmud, everything. Did they forget philosophy? Nope, it's all going into the fire. Every poem, every story ever written, up in smoke. Physics, chemistry, biology, medicine, the history of the Romans and Greeks, the Chinese, the Egyptians, all gone." "What a terrible, sad idea," Remy said. "We'd be back in the Stone Age with no map for the way back here." "It also makes me even more curious about the Codex," said Sam. "What was it that our friend managed to save from the fires? What's in here?" Cain shrugged. "That's what's been keeping me awake for 2 days." There was a knock on the door. "Come in," Sam called. Selma entered. "Am I too late?" "No," said Remy. "Professor David Cain, this is Selma Wondrash, who was kind enough to work with us as our chief researcher. Whatever the subject is, if Selma doesn't know the answer, she knows where it can be found." Cain stood and they shook hands. "Wondrash? It's not a common name. Are you related to the S.I. Wondrash who helped catalog the Inca Quipu?" "I am S.I. Wondrash," she said. "But the Quipu project was a long time ago." "And there hasn't been much progress in deciphering them since then," said Cain. "The strings and knots the Incas used to keep track of things are still incomprehensible to us."
"I keep hoping somebody will find an old Spanish document that records what an Inca informant said when he revealed how to interpret the different kinds and colors and lengths of strands in Quipu."
"We all do," said Cain. "The Spanish burned thousands of Quipu. There are only a few hundred left, but thanks to you, we at least know what exists."
Selma looked down at the codex on the table.
"Meanwhile, we have this."
"We do," Cain said. "Is everyone ready?"
The others all nodded. Cain put on his gloves and carefully opened the first page to reveal a striking painting. Tiny Mayans moved across the page carrying baskets. They were accompanied by warriors in full feathered battle regalia, wearing quilted armor, carrying round shields and wooden clubs with obsidian chunks along the edges. They went through plants that seemed to signify jungles. In one place, they passed over what appeared to be mountains, then arrived at a river valley. There were columns of glyphs covering the top third of the page.
"This is amazing," Cain said. "The page is a kind of stylized map, a set of directions. It says it leads from Copan to the Motagua River Valley, which is in Guatemala. See this glyph? It's Ya'ashchich, the Mayan term for jade."
"Are those people with the baskets going to find jade?" asked Remy.
"More likely to trade for it," said Cain. "Yes, it's trade. They're bringing valuable jungle products, bird feathers, jaguar skins, coca, to trade for jade."
Selma said jadeite was the most valuable substance in the Americas.
"The only known sources are Burma, Russia, and the Motagua Valley. This appears to show where that is."
Cain said,
After the Spanish came, the Mayans stopped going there and never told the Spanish where the jade came from. The Spanish wanted only gold and silver, so the location was forgotten. It was quite a mystery for a long time. Then in 1952, a hurricane passed over the Motagua Valley, and chunks of jade the size of cars washed out of the hillsides.
Sam said, then, until 1952, what we're looking at would have been a secret?
Absolutely, said Kane. To the Mayans, a very important secret.
And this is only the first page, said Remy.
As Kane turned the pages carefully, they stared in amazement. There were paintings of gods and heroes engaged in epic stories of creation and the end of eras.
There was a factual account of the warfare between Tikal and Calakmul, in which Copan backed Tikal. Kane deciphered and translated only enough of each set of glyphs to determine its subject. After about 30 pages, Kane turned a page to see a partial picture. Since the book was folded like an accordion, he could unfold two pages, lay them flat, and unfold two more to make one four-page display. There were paintings of forests, lakes, mountains, and all over the display were tiny pictures of Mayan buildings. Sam said, "It looks like a map." He pointed at a shape jutting out into water. "That looks like the Yucatan Peninsula." There were some buildings on the page that looked bigger than the others.
"What could that be?" asked Sam. "The glyphs say that's Chichen Itza," said Kane. "This on the coast is Sama, the ancient name of Tulum. Down here is Altunja, so this section is Belize. Here in Guatemala is Tikal. There's Palenque in Mexico."
"Are these all places you know?" asked Remy.
"Quite a few of them are. Bonampak, Xlapak, Copan. But there are many more names here. There are a number that I've never seen before. The current estimate is that about 60% of Mayan cities are known and mapped. Over 100 of them. But this shows, what, at least 300 of the large buildings that seem to be cities? I can see many I've never heard of. And there are lots of other sites that seem to be smaller cities. I'll have to compare them with the current inventory of sites."
Kane looked at his watch.
"Oh, I can't believe we've been at this for 5 hours. I have to get back to my office to pick up some things and then get home to start going over the existing sites to see what's not included. Can we take up where we left off tomorrow?"
"Sure," said Remy.
"I can get here around noon. My classes are all morning seminars tomorrow."
"We'll see you then," said Sam. Remy, Sam, and Zoltan walked Dr. Kane to the door and then watched him drive off. Chapter 8. La Jolla. At 10 the next morning, Sam and Remy were sitting together on the first floor, working at their computers to try to learn more about various aspects of Mayan civilization. While he was thinking about something he'd read, Sam's eyes moved off the screen to Remy. She wore a jade-green linen and silk dress that set off her eyes and her hair, and a pair of Manolo Blahnik sandals in bone leather. Zoltan lay at Remy's feet, looking contented. But suddenly the big dog let out a low growl, got up, walked through the house to the big double doors at the front and stood, watching them expectantly. Remy stood up and followed him, glancing out the window on the way.
"Sam," she called, "we've got visitors."
"Oh," he said. "Did Dave King come early?"
"It's some people in a black limo."
Sam stood and was walking toward the doors when the doorbell rang. Remy answered the door.
"Hello," she said. "Can I help you?"
It was a woman, accompanied by three men in dark suits. The woman was very attractive, with deep blue eyes and golden blonde hair pulled back into a perfect bun. She was expensively dressed in a blue suit. As she stepped forward and held out her hand, she spoke.
"I'm Sarah Allersby, Mrs. Fargo. Remy, isn't it?"
Her British accent was distinctly upper class.
"Well, yes," Remy said. "Is there something?"
Sarah Allersby said, "Please, call me Sarah.
and these gentlemen are my attorneys, Ronald Fife, Carlos Escobedo, and Jaime Salazar. May we come in?"
Remy stepped back and shook each attorney's hand as the four filed past her into the first floor of the house. Sam was waiting just inside. "And I'm Sam Fargo," he said. "May I ask what brings you here?"
"Charmed. I hope you don't mind my taking the unusual step of dropping by like this, but it was unavoidable and urgent. I live in Guatemala City, but I happened to be in Los Angeles last night on another matter when I heard the news, and it was too late to call. Long after business hours."
"We're not in business anymore," Sam said.
"How lucky you are. I'm an amateur archaeologist and collector specializing in Central America, but I still have to attend to mundane responsibilities."
"What news have you heard?" asked Remy.
"That your find at Volcan Tacaná in Mexico included a precious jar from Copan." She paused. "And also a Mayan codex."
"Interesting," Sam said, hiding his shock. "Where could you have heard that?"
She laughed softly.
"If I told people about my confidential sources, they wouldn't be confidential, and they'd stop being my sources. They'd hate me." "And their sources would hate them," said Sam.
"And so on," she said. "It's a whole ecosystem we have to protect."
Remy could feel that an awkward moment was stretching into an ordeal, and something about the woman's tone or scent was making Zoltan bristle. Remy petted his head to reassure him and said to her, "Please come in and sit down." Sarah Allersby looked at her watch as she followed Remy into the large open sitting area on the first floor. Sam led the guests to the leather couches arranged around a large glass coffee table near the windows with a view of the Pacific.
"Drink?" "Tea for all of us, I should guess," said Sarah.
The three lawyers didn't look eager, but she clearly was enforcing her own rule that she always guessed right. Sam sensed that she wanted to get Remy out of the room and start talking business. Remy walked off for a minute only. When she returned, she said, "Selma will bring it in when it's ready." Zoltan had followed her in. As she sat, Zoltan remained at her feet in a sphinx-like pose, his head erect and his ears straight up, his yellow and black eyes unblinking. Remy noticed it and scratched the back of his neck, but he remained as he was, his muscles ready to bring him up and into motion. Remy caught Sam's eye. Sam nodded slightly. He and Remy both knew that with these visitors, Zoltan was on guard. "This is Zoltan. Don't let him make you uncomfortable. He's very obedient." He paused. "What can we do for you, Miss Allersby?"
"I came because I hope you won't mind letting me see what you found on the volcano."
She smiled.
"I mean the codex, of course."
"We haven't said there was a codex," said Remy. Sarah Allersby's eyes moved to one of her attorneys, and Sam and Remy both caught a hint of irritation so fleeting that most people would have wondered if they'd imagined it.
"I'll be perfectly open," she said. "Several different confidential sources have confirmed that what you have is, without question, a genuine codex."
She smiled and looked at Remy. Remy watched her, saying nothing. So did Zoltan. Sarah persisted.
"While you're being cagey, Dr. Kane has made some calls to other academics here and abroad. Linguists, archaeologists, historians, geologists, biologists. He's told them what he's seen and what he thinks will be in the rest of the codex. So I know pretty much what you know. He's as good as verified publicly that the find is not a forgery. It's a genuine fifth codex."
Remy asked, "Why would any of those people reveal their conversations with Dr. Kane to you?"
"I have no illusion that I'm the only one who's been told. I just move faster than most of the others," said Sarah Allersby. "I and my family also control a great deal of money for grants and donations to universities. I sometimes let it be known that I'm interested in owning certain things, if they should ever turn up. And of course, no matter who owns certain objects, the objects will be kept in museums and universities. It matters a great deal to some people which ones are chosen.
Does Dr. Kane know that his colleagues are sharing his conversations with you? Asked Remy. She laughed.
I wouldn't know that. I assume he has his own patrons and sources of backing for his research and tells them what he wants them to know.
Her smile was almost a smirk. Her blue eyes were especially cold when she spoke to Remy. Sam could see that Miss Allersby had assumed that she would come in and dazzle him with her beauty while the mousy wife faded into the background somewhere.
She hadn't been able to adjust to being the second-best-looking woman in the room, and she didn't like being double-teamed by two questioners. She seemed to will her ego to deflate a little bit.
I don't flatter myself that I'm the only non-academic who knows. That's why I came immediately. And I've come such a long way. Can't I please see it? I've already shown you there's no reason for secrecy. The secret is out. And I am someone who genuinely cares about preserving and protecting these irreplaceable treasures, and have spent many millions doing it.
Sam looked at Remy, who nodded slightly. All right, he said. But we've got to be very careful with it. Only the first pages have been opened. We can't open more without risking having two surfaces stick together and damaging them. These couple of pages will have to do.
Agreed, she said. Where is it?
She looked around the large space with such eagerness that Sam felt uneasy. The pot and the codex are in a climate-controlled room, said Remy. It's right down here. She and Zoltan walked to the door of the room. She unlocked it. I'm afraid there's only space for two of you at a time. We can take turns. Sarah Allersby said, Don't worry. They're not here for that. They don't need to see it. She stepped in, Sam followed, and Remy entered and closed the door. Remy put on gloves, went to the cabinet, and produced the pot. Miss Allersby's eyes widened.
Incredible. I can see it's in the classic style of Copan.
She looked up at the rows of shelves behind the glass doors like a spoiled child who had been given a gift and gotten tired of it already. And the codex... Sam and Remy exchanged a glance, a mutual question. Do we really want to do this? Sam went to the rows of cabinets, unlocked one, and took down the codex. He carried it to the table, and Sarah Allersby's body turned toward it as though it had a magnetism that pulled her only. As Sam set it down, she leaned very close to it, too close.
Please be careful not to touch it, Remy said.
Sarah ignored her.
Open it.
Sam took a moment to pull the surgical gloves up his wrists so the fingers would be tighter. Open it, Sarah repeated. Sam lifted the cover to reveal the page about the jade deposits in the Motagua Valley.
What is that?
Asked Sarah.
Is that jade?
We're pretty sure it's a group from a jungle city going to the Motagua Valley to trade for it. As they went to the next page, she showed more and more signs of excitement.
I think this is part of the Popol Vuh, she said. The creation myth and all that. Here are the three feathered serpents. Here are the three sky gods.
When Sam reached the end of that section, he stopped, closed the book, and lifted it to its place in the glass cabinet, then locked the cabinet. Sarah Allersby took a moment to collect herself, returning slowly from the world of the Codex. They all went back to the couches in the sitting room, where Selma was serving tea and small pastries to the lawyers. As they returned, Selma served Sarah Allersby and the Fargos. Zoltan followed Remy to the couch and sat, watching the four visitors.
Well, that was a thrill, Sarah said. It's everything I've heard and more. If the rest of it is blank, it's still amazing.
She sipped her tea.
I would like to make a preemptive offer before this goes any further. Does $5 million sound fair?
We aren't selling anything, said Remy. Sarah Allersby bristled. Sam could tell that she had now used the second of her two best weapons to little effect.
Her looks had already failed to impress. On rare occasions when that was the case, her family's money almost always restored the proper awe. Remy had passed over the money without comment.
Why on earth not?
It doesn't belong to us, for starters. It belongs to Mexico.
Surely you aren't serious. You've already smuggled it all the way here. It's in your house, in your possession. Why would you go to that trouble, risk arrest and imprisonment if you don't want it?
Sam said it was an emergency. We did what we could to preserve the find. What we could do was to remove what was movable away from the site before it got carried off by thieves or the earthquakes and the volcano destroyed it. We also enlisted the local people to protect the shrine. Once we've given the experts a chance to study and preserve the codex, it has to go back to Mexico. Sarah Allersby leaned toward him as though she were about to spit.
7 million.
May I? Asked Fife, the British attorney. Virtually nobody knows that you have the codex. All you have to do is sign a sale agreement and a non-disclosure agreement, and the money will be wired to a bank or collection of banks of your choice in the next few hours.
We're not selling anything, said Remy.
Careful, said Sarah. When I walk out that door, it will mean that we couldn't agree. Since you've demonstrated that you weren't above smuggling it out of Mexico, I have to assume that the true obstacle was that you want a higher price.
The Mexican lawyer Escobedo said,
I assure you, this is the best way to proceed. At some point, the Mexican government will take an interest. We can deal with them far better than you can. You've been in the Mexican newspapers. If you have the codex, you must have stolen it from the shrine on Tacaná. If Miss Allersby has it, she can say it came from anywhere. One of her plantations in Guatemala, perhaps. And Tacaná is on the Guatemalan border. A few yards this way or that, and transporting the codex becomes perfectly legal.
Salazar took his turn.
If you're worried that the codex will be locked away where it won't be studied by scientists, don't be. The codex will be in a museum, and scientists will be able to apply for access to it, just as they do all over the world. Miss Allersby simply wants to be the legal owner, and is willing to protect you from any litigation or government inquiry.
I'm very sorry, Sam said, but we can't sell what we don't own. The codex has to go to the Mexican government. I believe there's information in it that might be used by grave robbers, pot hunters, and thieves to locate and destroy important sites before archaeologists could ever hope to reach them. We're not rejecting your offer. We're rejecting all offers.
Sarah Allersby stood and looked at her watch. We've got to be going, I'm afraid.
She sighed.
I made you such a large offer because I didn't want to wait years to buy it from some Mexican institution at auction. But if waiting is necessary, I can do that. At some point, rationality sets in and bureaucrats realize that a whole new library is better than one old book. Thank you for the tea.
She turned, and in a moment she was out the door. Her lawyers had to hurry to get out and down the sidewalk in time to open the car door for her.
Remy said, I have a feeling about her.
So do I. Zoltan stared out the window at the limousine and growled. Sam and Remy walked back to the climate-controlled room, put on surgical gloves again, took the pot and the codex and carried them out. They went through the secret door in the bookcase, down the stairs to the lower level of the new firing range. Sam opened the gun cabinet, put the codex on a shelf with the pot, closed the safe, and spun the dial of the lock.
They went back upstairs, and Remy said to Selma, Are all the new security systems up and running yet?
Yes.
Good. But don't sleep here tonight. Arm all the systems and go to your apartment. We're going to have a break-in tonight.
It was only 10:45, so Sam and Remy drove to the campus of the University of California, San Diego. They found a parking structure not far from the anthropology department, then walked there. As they approached David Kane's office,
They saw the door open and a male student leave his office, looking down at a paper and frowning. Kane said to the student, "Just get the bibliography and notes in shape before you hand it in." Then he saw the Fargos.
"Sam! Remy! What's up?"
He beckoned them into his office and shut the door, then moved piles of books off chairs for them.
"I thought we were going to meet at your house."
Sam said, "We had a visit about an hour ago from a woman named Sarah Allersby."
"You didn't."
"You know her?" asked Remy.
"Only by reputation."
Sam said, "She's apparently been fed information by at least one of the colleagues you spoke with. She offered us $7 million for the Codex. She knew what was in it."
"Oh, no," he said. "I only spoke with people I thought I could trust. I never took into account the sort of temptation a person like that can offer."
"What do you know about her?" asked Remy.
"More than I want to. She's one of a whole class of people who have been filling gigantic houses in Europe and North America with pilfered artifacts for over 100 years. They used to travel to undeveloped countries in the 19th century and take what they wanted. In the 20th century, they paid galleries huge prices for objects that grave robbers dug up. By buying some, they created a market for more. They couldn't be bothered to wonder what some object really was, where it came from, or how it was obtained. As things stand today, if I were in a hurry to find the most sacred objects in existence, I wouldn't dig for them, and I wouldn't search in museums. I'd look in the homes of people in Europe and America whose families have been wealthy for the last 100 or so years.
"Is that the Allersbys?" asked Remy.
"They're among the worst," Kane said. "They've been at it since the British arrived in India. It wasn't even frowned upon until about 30 years ago. Even now, if an object left its country of origin before the United Nations treaty signed in the 1970s, you can do anything you want with it. Keep it, sell it, or put it in your garden as a bird bath. That loophole exists because rich people like the Allersbys exerted influence on their country's governments."
Sarah seemed pretty comfortable with the idea that we'd smuggled the Codex out of Mexico for sale, said Remy. He shook his head.
"It's ironic. I've heard the British tabloids spend a lot of ink on her bad behavior in the Greek islands and the French Riviera. But what she does in Guatemala is worse, and it's serious."
"Why?"
"Guatemala had a civil war between 1960 and 1996. 200,000 people died in that war. A lot of the old Spanish landowning families sold out and moved to Europe. The ones who bought those huge stretches of land were mostly foreigners. One of them was Sarah Allersby's father. He bought a gigantic place called the Estancia Guerrero from the last heir, who had been living high in Paris and gambling in Monaco. When Sarah turned 21, her father settled a lot of property on her, buildings in several European capitals, businesses, and the Estancia Guerrero."
"It sounds pretty routine for rich families," said Remy.
"Well, suddenly this 21-year-old girl, just out of school in England, became one of the most important people in Guatemala. Some people predicted that she would be a progressive force, someone who would stand up for the poor Mayan peasants. The opposite happened. She visited her holdings in Guatemala and liked the place so much she moved there. That is, she liked Guatemala just the way it was. She became part of the new oligarchy, the foreigners who own about 80% of the land, and an even higher proportion of everything else. They exploit the peasants as much as the old Spanish landowners they replaced."
"That's disappointing."
"It was to everyone except the peasants, who can't be surprised anymore. Meet the new boss, just like the old boss.
She's got a great hunger for Mayan artifacts, but no love at all for the living Mayan people who work in her fields and her businesses for practically nothing."
"Well," said Sam, "obviously we're not selling her anything. Where do you think we should go from here?
We should do something about my colleagues.
I need to know who is honest and who isn't. I'd like to tell each of the people I've told about the Codex a different lie about what's in the rest of it, and see which lie Sarah Allersby acts on.
I'm afraid it's too late for that, said Remy.
When we asked about her sources, she wouldn't answer. I'm sure she'll be expecting us to try to find out.
What we've got to do is try to pursue two paths at once, Kane said.
What are the two paths? Sam asked.
The Codex has to be examined, transcribed, and translated. We have to know what it says.
That's hard to argue with, said Remy. The other line of inquiry is a bit trickier. At some point, we've got to find out whether the Codex is fiction or a description of the world as it was in those days. The only way to do it is to go down to Central America and verify that what it says is true and accurate.
You mean to visit one of the sites it describes? Asked Sam.
I'm afraid so, Kane said.
I had been hoping to lead a scientific expedition to one of the sites that is mentioned only in this Codex. But we're 2 weeks into the spring quarter, with 9 more weeks to go. I can't leave my classes now. And it takes time to get a big expedition together. With Sarah Allersby involved, time is scarce. The longer we wait, the more difficult she'll make it. She's capable of getting people set up to follow any expedition we organize, getting us arrested, doing anything to get us to sell the Codex or make sure we can't have access to it.
We'll be the expedition, Remy said. Sam and me.
What? Said Sam. I thought you didn't want to travel for a while.
You heard him, Sam. There are 2 things that have to be done. Neither of us knows how to read the 861 glyphs in the Mayan writing system, and we don't know the underlying language. What's it called?
Cholan, said Kane.
Right, she said. Cholan. How's your Cholan?
I see what you mean, Sam said.
Dave?
See if you can find a site that fits the criteria, mentioned only in this codex, never explored, and small enough that we don't need a big group that will attract attention. I'd like to slip in there, find it, and get out.
Chapter 9. La Jolla. Early the next morning, Sam, Remy, and Zoltan arrived at the house above Goldfish Point before the electricians and carpenters, who were still working on the 4th floor. As they started up the walk, Selma opened the front door and came out to meet them. She put her hands on her hips.
The police just left.
Remy said, So we had visitors last night?
Yes, said Selma. The burglars tried the front doors but couldn't get them to budge. Banging on them and trying to jimmy the latches caused the steel shutters on the 1st and 2nd floors to come down automatically. The silent alarm from the outdoor surveillance cameras and motion sensors had already alerted the police. The cameras got only the images of 2 figures dressed in black with ski masks.
Were you hoping to see their best work? Remy asked.
No, Sam said. But I'm wondering if they might not have suspected in advance that this place wasn't going to be easy.
Oh, said Selma. That implies that they'd been here before.
Sam shrugged. If I were to guess, I'd say that you probably served them tea yesterday. I don't mean Sarah Allersby came back with a crowbar. I mean that she just may have read us wrong. Thought that if someone showed us that it's dangerous to have a valuable artifact around, then we'd jump at her offer.
One more thing, said Selma. Dave Kane left a message on the house phone last night. He wants to meet with you this morning about your next little trip.
2 hours later, they were in the climate-controlled room with David Kane. They stood around the work table, comparing the map in the Codex with a topographic map on a computer screen. Kane placed a small arrow pointing to a spot in the jungle.
This site meets our criteria. It's not included in any inventory of known Mayan sites.
It isn't large enough to be a major city. It has the advantage of being in an area of the Guatemalan highlands that's sparsely populated and remote. What do you think it is? Asked Remy. The glyphs say it's a sacred pool.
I believe it's a cenote, a hole in the underlying limestone bedrock caused by the action of water.
Like a sinkhole?
Exactly. Water was an extremely precious commodity to the Mayans, and it became more so in the late Classic period. You would think water would be plentiful on the floor of a jungle, but it isn't. And after the Mayans had cut and burned miles of trees to clear fields for agriculture, the climate got hotter and drier. During the late period, many cities depended heavily on cenotes as a water source. We've even found man-made cisterns they dug and plastered at El Mirador that were imitation cenotes, with artificial streams leading to them for catching water. Sam said, "You want us to look for a pool of water?" Cenotes were more than that. They were doorways to the underworld. Chuck, the god of rain and weather, lived down there, among other places. You have to understand that these were people who believed that what they did kept the universe operating correctly. If you wanted rain, you would throw sacrifices into a cenote where the gods would get them.
And this is the best site.
There are new cities on this map. Either they're imaginary or lost, we don't know which. But you can't go down there with a huge crew and try to excavate or even map a city without months of preparation. And if you did, it would compromise the site and expose it to looters. A cenote can be hidden or overgrown, but it's something you can verify without attracting too much attention. There. I've just given you all the reasons why it's a good choice.
Remy said, I sense there are reasons why it's not.
You're right, he said. It's near a vast piece of land owned by a foreign landlord. It's called the Estancia Guerrero.
Sarah Allersby, said Remy.
Yes, he said. It's an unfortunate coincidence. But anywhere in Guatemala, we would be on or near one of these big estates. They occupy hundreds of square miles, much of it uncultivated.
Maybe not so unfortunate, said Sam. While she's trying to get her hands on the codex, she won't be on her land, causing trouble for us.
I doubt that she spends much time on the land in any case. She leads a very active social, political, and business life in Guatemala City.
Sounds good, said Sam. While we're gone and you're working on the codex, we'll keep in touch. Selma and her assistants, Pete and Wendy, are ready to offer you as much help as you'd like. Selma you already know. Pete and Wendy are young, but both have plenty of history and archaeology experience.
Kane looked down at the codex on the table.
Selma told me about the burglary.
It hardly deserves that name, Sam said.
I'm wondering if it's safe to keep the codex here while you're out of the country.
Do you have any better ideas? Asked Remy.
I was wondering if you'd let me look into the possibility of keeping the codex on campus.
Normally there wouldn't be a problem with keeping it at our house, said Remy. But there's still remodeling going on upstairs, with workmen coming and going all day. And now Sarah Allersby and her amateur burglars know where the codex is.
She paused.
Would the university be safer?
University campuses are full of valuable things. Supercomputers, famous works of art, experimental devices of every kind, said Kane. Besides, the university has a few things you don't. Like a police force.
That sounds like a good idea, said Sam. Look into the possibility of locking it up on campus. If you find it's practical, we'll do it. If not, we can rent a joint safe deposit box in a bank, and you can work there.
Good, said Kane. I'll talk to my dean and let you know. When can you leave for Guatemala?
Tomorrow, said Sam. We'd like to get there, verify the site, and get back here.
If you do, then maybe we can begin to organize a large team to find one of the big cities on the map this summer. I'd like you to consider joining that team. There's nobody I'd rather have with me.
We'll consider it, said Remy, after we finish our scouting mission.
Sam and Remy spent the rest of the day preparing for their trip to Guatemala. They packed, arranged to have the proper